All right, so welcome. Just some real quick preliminaries. I mentioned the drawing in the back for the books. Please put your name in the hat. This link tree here, my apologies. I didn't finish the handout for the workshop until like last night. So it's only online. I didn't have it printed, but you can find it there, which actually makes it more useful because it's a Google Doc and it has a million links in it to resources we'll be talking about. So anyway, look that up, and then you'll have it for afterwards also. And it also links to the presentation. So welcome. My name is John McGee. I work for the Agricultural Justice Project. And I'll say more about that in a minute. But basically, today we're going to talk about fair labor practices, mostly fair labor practices. And we'll get some time for discussion and Q&A. And I pass to my co-presenter.
Hi, everyone. I'm Adam Peterson. I am with the Chicago Food Policy Action Council. I am the Chicago Good Food Purchasing Program Manager. And we'll get much more into what good food purchasing is and how that relates to labor and livelihoods.
All right. So, quick outline of what we're going to do today. So I'm going to sort of like set the frame real quick just for a few minutes and talk about what we're talking about. And I know that I put in the description that we're going to talk about labor law. I apologize. I like realized when practicing for this workshop, there's no way to talk about labor law and fair practices in the same workshop and do either of them justice. So I kicked it all to the handout. There's a lot of resources in there. If you're here for labor law, look in the handout. We are mostly going to talk about fair practices, and really we'll just weave together the sort of, you know, me showing slides and Q&A. And then at the end, Adam's going to get a good slot for talking about the Good Food Purchasing Program. So, okay, a couple questions real quick. Can I see a show of hands? Who's a farmer or farm operator? Great. Who works on farms as like an employee? Great. No, totally, yeah. All right, well, welcome. There's a little bit of this for everybody here. I'll tell you a bit about the Agricultural Justice Project. We are a coalition organization of farm workers and farm owners, farm operators, small organic produce growers and fruit growers and ranchers. The organization came together about 25 years ago as all of those folks wanted to hash out a vision for what fairness and justice would look like on US farms. And out of all those discussions, out of like many, many meetings, they put together a set of standards. And it covers all the different links in the food chain from production on the farms to retail and restaurants and such. As far as farms go, there's basically like two components. There's the bucket of like fair labor practices on the farms, and then there's the bucket of fair trading and fair prices between the buyers and the farmers. So this might be a little bit of preaching to the choir if you're here at a fairness presentation, but I think it's helpful to just sort of ground us in like why we need fairness on farms, why we need cooperation. And like the most obvious answer, of course, is that we don't have those things. Like we are generally, there are some really stellar farms out there, but also we generally don't do that well. And a lot of the reason for that, of course, is that we're still carrying a legacy of white supremacy, genocide, and exploitation of labor. So yeah, we need fairness and cooperation because we're not going to get over those things without without fairness for everybody. At one level, it does make good business sense to have to, you know, implement fair practices, but just like in to begin with, I want to sort of paint the bigger picture. Just like the practice of solidarity on a daily way is how we're going to like rise together. In the words of Fannie Lou Hamer, nobody is free until everybody's free. So the AJP's vision of a just food system is basically built on solidarity and mutual aid. So that means cooperation at all of these different levels. In the case of producers, that means producer co-ops. In the case of workplaces, it means, you know, all the fair practices I'm going to be talking about today, moving towards workplace democracy, sort of the far horizon of worker-owned co-ops. And in the community, it means the solidarity economy. So relations of mutual aid, owning the means of distribution, and CSAs, public institutions that are accountable to our values. So AJP aspires to be a movement-building organization. But that obviously means, like, you know, we're also the nonprofit industrial complex. There's only so much we can do. So our vision is that, like, you know, the sort of cooperative side of things, the alternative system, is never going to be enough to completely get us over the finish line. And so we're promoting cooperation and solidarity as, it, like, acknowledging that this is the foundation, just the foundation for collective action, for, you know, big, much bigger movements that are connected across many issues and actually have the power to win political change. So anyway, that's the like huge macro picture. And I just share that because hopefully that'll help us to see how like the micro of our everyday practices fits into that picture. All right, this is where we zoom over a dozen slides. The main thing that I do want to say about labor law before we move on is that I think we all probably know this intuitively, but the law on its own is like not enough. The law is not fair. The law is really important. It's like a backstop. It has lots of like really important provisions. But the reality is that like the US is like far behind all of our peer countries. Our labor law is still in the 19th century. That's the background against which the AJP is promoting these standards, fair labor standards, to try to demonstrate that an alternative is possible. Like I mentioned, there's a bunch of resources linked in the handout there. Okay, so my thought is that we can basically go through sort of like some of the different categories of types of standards and then maybe have some discussion so you don't have to listen to me talking the entire time. But basically, this is our certification program. So if you met all of these standards, you could get Food Justice certified and put this logo on your products. But that said, like, you know, my job is technical assistance. I help like hundreds of farms who never decide to go all the way to certification. I'm still like helping folks to implement, you know, as much as they're up for. Okay, so the first big bucket is collective bargaining. At the federal level, farm workers are excluded from the right of collective bargaining and protections for unions, which is one big reason why farm conditions are as bad as they are. But in the AJP standards, we basically bring the farm workplace up to the same level as you know, non-farm workplaces, and then we go a little bit further. So the first piece is freedom of association. So this means like the right of workers to act together and to join organizations as they choose without any interference. So that could be a union, doesn't have to be a union, could be any organization, doesn't even have to be a formal organization. But the farmer agrees, the owner of the farm, employer agrees to respect however employees want to organize. Similarly, sort of, okay, so collective bargaining is like another step beyond freedom of association. It's, you know, referring to workers' rights to raise work-related concerns, negotiate terms of their employment, make complaints and grievances, and to do all of that together, again, without any reprisals from the owner. And in the case of the AJP, our standards stipulate that the owner has to voluntarily recognize any organizing effort that their employees are doing. And part of that, of course, is agreeing to negotiate in good faith with those employees. The one last piece about freedom of association is that I learned recently, last week, that Rocksteady Farm, if any of you guys are familiar with them in New York, they call this the buddy system. But basically, if you have a meeting with management, then you can bring anybody you want in with you to advocate with you, support you, whatever it is, you have that right. Okay, so I don't know, do we want to talk about unions for a minute? Do folks have thoughts about unions and farms? Yeah, I mean, then you have like other co-ops that are like basically founded by unions. You know, the whole movement in like Dayton and Cincinnati, Co-op Cincy. Although, I mean, to my knowledge, only one of those co-ops is a farm. But yeah, I mean, has anyone ever tried to negotiate with your employer or the other way around, negotiate with your employees about working conditions?
I have about 8 full-time employees during the summer, and we've always had a very open door policy, and I've had situations where they've, you know, a handful will have come to me and been like, hey, you know, we'd like it if you'd more often have that igloo cooler and just assume that we're going to want it every day and just, you know, fill it up with ice, and we really like that touch where you put some sliced cucumbers in it. I mean, it's situations like that, but I mean, it's not like I've had this uprising where they had torches and pitchforks and stuff, but.
Yeah.
I could just share that, you know, I formed co-ops because the workers didn't want a boss anymore. Uh-huh. So, I mean, there's that option too, where, you know, workers sort of take over the business. So I ran the only cooperatively owned, with 10 other people, cooperatively owned coffee shop in Madison for years. And then, like, when the Starbucks organizing started happening, we had a lot of stuff we could share with them because we knew how union organizing goes because we formed a co-op as workers. And so it's just, there's lots of different models for workers to be involved in a workplace. You could run it yourself, you know. It doesn't have to have a boss-worker structure. So.
Just to, I formed the co-op Scenic Central Milk Producers, had our first meeting September 1st in 98 in my community hall in Kendall, Wisconsin. We ended up fighting state of Wisconsin red tape until July 1st in 99, but started shipping milk in July of 99, and Scenic Central is a cooperative that strictly markets milk, you know, did not invest in infrastructure, so we just rent trucks that pick up farmers' milk and deliver them to the end buyer. But one of the things we did is our first general manager was also a Modern Woodman representative, so we started Roth IRAs for all of our farmers. So if the farmer kicked in a nickel, a hundredweight, then the co-op would kick in, match a nickel. So we started retirement plans where farmers never, ever even dreamed of having a retirement plan and finally give them options. And I've talked to Apple co-ops and stuff that all, like, that's just ingenious, you know, give incentive.
Yeah.
Because you could do that for employees and for workers, just, you know, that little step of acknowledging that you appreciate them could be as simple as starting something like that. And it doesn't have to be huge, but it's something that will grow and build for them. So just ideas to help the process.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so in the handout, I actually linked to some testimony from Jim Cochran of Swanton Berry Farm, who one of his claims to fame was that, you know, he's one of the first organic strawberry growers. But also in the late 90s, he invited the UFW to talk with his workers, and they could, you know, he would voluntarily recognize a union if they wanted to form one. And he said it's been the best experience. It's basically like having a, like the having the union contract is like having an HR department, he says. Basically, they kind of, you know, they have a defined grievance process. You know, the negotiations are very structured. There's a lot of hand-holding from the union for the negotiations.
I think that's interesting, too, just like that insight that he just shared from their very farm in the sense that, you know, we all, farm owners and farm workers alike put a lot of themselves into the work, you know, not only your physical, you know, energy, but I think a lot of us come to this work because we actually care about what we're doing, which I think also makes it, when there's conflict around anything, very personal to both parties, which as human beings, I'm sure we can all relate, only escalates emotion or escalates the us versus them mentality at times. And a union kind of offers like a third party, almost, you know, negotiating area where it can take care of some of that, you know, just natural conflict that would arise if you were trying to talk about, you know, whatever it is in your operation. So I like that insight.
Yeah. Thanks. Okay, well, for the sake of time, I'm going to move us on to the next bucket, which I like to call due process. Basically, these standards are provisions that are familiar from any standard union contract. You guys are all probably familiar with the common employee handbook language that says, you know, the farm reserves the right to fire you for any reason at any time. And that is out the window. Under the AJP standards, you can only be fired or disciplined for a just cause. And what that means is that is basically a couple things. One is that you have to have very clear expectations for performance and for behavior, attendance and all of that outlined in your handbook and in your trainings. And you also have to communicate them when folks are not meeting those expectations so that folks know where they stand and that they know how they're being judged. And likewise, you have to have a stepped disciplinary process, again, so that people are notified when there's a problem before it reaches a point of possibly termination. Likewise, because there's always conflict that comes up when people work together, you have to have a defined conflict resolution process. And then also because conflicts don't just happen between equals, they also happen across, you know, imbalances of power, like between the owner and a worker. So there also has to be some provision in that conflict resolution for grievances, appealing to some independent arbitrator or mediator, like the, I don't know if y'all are familiar with the Ag Mediation Program. It provides free, usually free, mediation services to any farm business. Likewise, that grievance process has to include the right to appeal. So, you know, if someone's disciplined or if someone is fired, then there's a process again that if they feel like it was, if the employee feels like it was unjustly done, then they can appeal to the mediator or to some independent authority. In the case of Food Justice Certified Farms, that is the AJP. We fulfill that role. There's also provisions for basic transparency, just meaning that, sort of like I've said, folks need to know where they stand. So they have to have access to their personnel files, which should include any disciplinary action, any evaluations, because, you know, not only do folks need an opportunity to improve if there's an issue, but they also need the opportunity to respond and sort of, you know, present their side of a case. And there's no retaliation allowed by employers for any exercise of any of these rights by employees. Yes, we do. Totally, yeah. So we have a whole resource library that we call the AJP Toolkit. I think our employee handbook template might be the easiest way. It's pretty radically different from the typical extension handbook. Mm-hmm. And it does include all of these things, sort of like, you know, an outline of behavior expectations, an outline of a conflict, simple conflict resolution process, all that stuff. I'm sorry, I forgot to give you the microphone.
I think just thinking about how small my farm is, we maybe have 3 to 6 employees every season. So getting into the grievance process would be tricky for us, because if that's not free, like, that's a pretty big... So, and also just the idea for us as a really small farm to get to that point would be extremely personal. You know, it would be very much... like, what have we done wrong in that process to get to that point? Because I think I get it, it's a safety net, right? And it's a safety net for everyone. But if you have really good practices in place for open communication and things like that, then, you know, totally. You hope you would never have to use that.
Exactly, that's the hope.
Yeah.
Well, I will say that I don't know about in Wisconsin, and I don't know who that, where are you?
I'm in Minnesota.
In Minnesota, okay. Does anybody know about the Ag Mediation Program provider in Minnesota?
It's in both Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Okay.
You absolutely can access the services of that organization from either state.
Yeah, so in my experience, I don't know this particular agency, but they all receive, like, you know, funding from the USDA specifically to offer free mediation services. So it's actually a great resource, because it's not just for, like, on-farm conflicts. It could also be, like, if you have a landlord, if you have a lender, if you have a buyer, you know, problems with any of them, like the...
Like if you're leasing land.
Yep, if you're leasing land. Yeah, any relationship around the farm that could go wrong, the Ag Mediation Program is funded to provide that service. But yeah, so the way the toolkit is set up, I'll just say, like, the model handbook has, like, a lot of things, like, really sort of like the simplest version of all of these pieces. And then the rest of the toolkit often has like sort of special examples that have been provided to us by other farms that have implemented something. And so if you're hunting around for something that feels a little bit more natural to you or speaks to you, there's other options. Yeah, and has anyone ever been fired for no reason? Or for a reason that wasn't clear to you, or had any experience with that?
I was, like, a million years ago, I was just out of high school.
Long time ago, I was a temp worker, and I was doing temp work, and I was assigned to work at a car dealership, and I just got a call from the temp agency one day, and they said the dealership's requesting that you not show up anymore for work. And I asked why, and they said that they're refusing to give a reason. And that always just stuck with me. Because I literally have no idea what they thought was wrong with me. So.
Just a kind of situation I'll pose to everybody and kind of see what people think. But recently had a coworker that was a surrogate mother. So she worked 8.5 months pregnant, took her maternity leave, but the company demanded that she come back early because she took her full 12 weeks. But they were saying that because she only had the child for 2 days and then it was given to the parents, that she wasn't able to take her full 12 weeks. And she still took her 12 weeks, and the day she came back, they terminated her.
Oh,
so what's people's thoughts on that?
I mean, for one thing, that seems, for one thing, that should be illegal. I mean, I think it is 100% illegal.
So then were they using, was the thought there that they were using the, what is it called again, John? The term, the right to
The Family Medical Leave Act?
No, like the, in the state of Wisconsin anyway, where you can fire someone without
at will.
Thank you, yeah, at will. Were they using at will as their reasoning for that? Or?
I'm not sure what was in the end, because by the time I knew about it, she was gone, and then, a few of us had just the conversation amongst ourselves, but we're just like blown away that, that she actually did that for
Yeah, I mean, the federal law is pretty clear that it's not just childbirth for your own child. It's any medical issue that you need leave for. So this is one of the reasons why Just Cause is so important as a policy, is that, so this coworker of yours in this really unfortunate situation, she has a really strong case. She could get a labor lawyer and come back and sue the company, for lost wages, might be able to get her job back, but the burden gets put on her. Mm-hmm. And then there's the question of, like, do I really want to work for these jerks who fired me for this? obviously, it sounds like Ocean Spray is not running to implement Just Cause, but, in terms of having a better practice and, like establishing the fact that, we can do better than that, Just Cause means that there's actually a process that folks know what's going on and they have a way to sort of have back and forth about it. It's not just unilaterally dictated, you're out of here tomorrow or whenever it is. I don't know. I'm not a labor lawyer. The question was, does there need to be a standard operating procedure so that employees are informed of their rights under the Family Medical Leave Act? I know that they're required to put a poster up in the workplace. Yes. Yep. No, I mean, I think everyone is agreeing with you here that she was done wrong.
It's supposed to be practice.
Yeah.
Regulation-wise.
Yeah. But, you know, the system of labor law that we have in the U.S. puts the burden on the workers to sue. And that's the only way you ever get justice as a fired worker is if you sue the employer who fired you. And, of course, like, you know, workers rarely, even when they have a good case, they rarely follow through on that because there's the chance.
They're intimidated.
It costs money to get a lawyer.
And
they harass them. And they have to go and find another job because they don't have a job. So,
yeah.
Did you have a question?
Similar situation where I worked for a year for an organization that wasn't paying its workers' comp insurance in Minnesota, and they're supposed to have posters up informing you of your right to worker comp insurance, and they also weren't offering us PTO, and that was a similar thing, where in the state or the city of St. Paul, you're supposed to be informed that you have right to PTO. So that lack of information posted led to us not knowing for a year that we were deprived of those rights. It's really important to have that stuff up.
Yeah. That's why, imagine this, they have to really read the fine print, right? The fine print is so important.
Well, the fine print is important, as you say, and also having a worker advocate, you know, having like a worker organization that can help you to know your rights and to help you to exercise those rights. And to talk to the employer and say you're not doing what you're required to do, and all of that.
But that is a part of the human resources.
Well, but human resources is paid by the employer. The nice thing about sort of a worker organization is that, you know, there's no conflict of interest there. You know, the worker organization is sort of like an independent basis for you know, power and of workers. All right, well, maybe we can move on to the very exciting bucket of fair compensation. okay, so AJP, our standards require that employers pay living wages, which just means that a living wage is the minimum amount that would cover a life of dignity. So covering all of your basic needs like housing and food and healthcare, utilities, childcare, transportation, and a certain amount for savings. So that is obviously something that is calculated for your local area and your local cost of living. We have resources on the AJP website, which just sort of like walk you through the process of figuring out, based on your compensation package at your farm, based on the living wage that MIT calculates the base living wage for your area. You can just kind of look up your county or your metro area on MIT's website. Our spreadsheet calculator helps you to plug that number in, see like if you're offering benefits like housing or food or whatever it might be, healthcare, how that affects the final dollar amount that you should be paying your employees for them to earn a living wage. Obviously, a lot of farms don't have a lot of room in the budget to be paying higher wages. So recognizing that, we have a set of alternate requirements that a farm can meet. So if you can't pay your employees a living wage yet, then basically the first thing is to share your accounting with your employees. It doesn't have to be like in great detail, but opening up the books and explaining, this is why I can't pay you more right now. So a bit of transparency there. And then also, whatever wages you are paying them, you have to be willing to negotiate them. You have to sort of open up that negotiation process. And sort of along the same lines as the open books, you have to make a plan with your employees of how are we gonna try to achieve living wages. There's no guarantees, obviously. But to set a goal, to sort of like, you know, look at the living wages, see how much it would cost you to reach that level, and to think about your business plan and how you can get there. Part of the goal there, of course, is that employees also have a lot of wisdom and expertise that they can bring to the business. They know the work pretty well. And so if the goal of the business is to afford better wages, most employees would be pretty jazzed to work towards that goal. You also, if you make profit, and if you make more profits, then you have to raise your wages of your employees along with the profits. And this last one almost never applies because most farms don't get there. But basically, there's also a cap. You know, on the ratio of the highest paid employee to the lowest paid employee can't exceed 8-1.
I mean, with co-ops, I've been told it's supposed to be 4-1. That's what I've been learning at all the co-op things. Like, that's supposed to be the norm for a co-op, but that's not applied either.
Yeah, I mean, this is in there primarily because, you know, we also, like, we have never had, like, particularly large farms get certified, obviously. I mean, like, most of them are not inclined this way. But that's kind of the situation when this cap might come in to play. So I don't know, have any of y'all calculated living wages? Or are you familiar with living wages in your area?
One of the big problems here is, like, if you get H-2A workers, they're guaranteed 18, which is above the minimum living wage calculation. So that's, like, another issue maybe. But so we might be providing, you know, living wages for domestic workers, but then somebody else might be getting paid more in the same. This was a big discussion about worker conditions at the Organic Veggie Conference I was at 2 weeks ago in Madison. We had a whole workshop on fairness amongst different workers in the same workplace.
Yeah.
So just well, to be aware of that. Yeah,
there's, I mean, so the H-2A workers are usually required, correct me if I'm wrong, that they have the adverse effect wage rate that H-2A employers are required to pay. Sorry, do folks know what H-2A is? Okay, so H-2A is a temporary guest worker visa. So these are folks mostly from Mexico, but also from other places like Central America and Jamaica. Also even South Africa, who are coming in on temporary visas. They have to go home at the end of the season. They can't stay more than 10 months at a time. It's a highly regulated. Sorry, what was that?
They can hide?
They do, yeah. I mean, some people do skip out on returning, yeah.
Somebody needs them, too.
But, yeah, I mean, the there's a lot of problems with the H-2A program because workers in the H-2A program have a lot fewer rights than workers in the rest of the economy. Can you pass her the microphone, please?
They always go through that process, sir, but at the same time, they can get over with the system. Like I said, after they hire them, then they work through the process. They get an immigration lawyer, and then they work it through. Then they can stay here.
I think in practice, unfortunately, that almost never happens because.
No, it happens.
Well, I mean, I don't doubt that it happens, but the worker organizations that are part of the AJP are really clear that the real problem with H-2A is that workers are tied to a single employer, and so. Your visa has the name of your employer on it. If that gig ends, you're kicked out of the country immediately. It is true that some people can skip out, but it's very hard, and then, of course, you're on the lam. So. Yeah. Did you have something you want to say?
Well, I have a separate question. more around like living wages, so we can like look up what a living wage is in an area, but I feel like a lot of farm workers, there's also this, you know, housing, there's
yes.
food, like,
yes.
and thinking about, okay, open books and living wages, but like, is it, you know, if you're not paying rent, like how to calculate that in
totally.
in a different way, because I think it's really nuanced, and I don't know the
yeah.
resources that exist, because
yes.
it's often like, okay, we'll pay you $500, but you get all this other stuff for free,
right?
And that doesn't seem like
yeah,
very
so that
fair.
This little piece, the spreadsheet calculator, that's what we put together to sort of help to, you know, you can plug in what MIT says the living wage is, assuming that you're paying for all of those things out of pocket. You can plug that number in, and then you can enter in the value of the different benefits that the farm workers are getting, say like housing, food, whatever it might be, and it sort of does the math and spits out a different hourly wage. I think I put that together after you did it, so you probably had to do it by hand. Sorry about that, Emmeline, but.
I think a related question about living wage and the component of that that is meant to be savings, or sort of how savings is calculated within a living wage. I'm thinking particularly in the context of farms where, you know, the farm owner may be in debt but has that asset wealth that they're building.
Yeah.
How are we making sure that the farm workers can also be building wealth in the form of savings if they're wage labor?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so... this is a good thing to talk about, because the MIT calculation does not actually include savings. So one of the things that our little calculator spreadsheet does is it adds 10% for savings. One of the lines is savings. Because obviously that is really important. I mean, especially for seasonal work, you know, you need to have some money put away for stability. But also, obviously, for, you know, just building wealth in the long run. Yeah, it's a hard thing. I don't think that we have a really like spelled out formula for assessing the question of like the equity that a farm owner is building. I think that would mostly come into play. One of the parts that we're probably not going to get much time to talk about today, but basically, if like a food co-op wanted to get food justice certified, then they would have to be committing to paying fair prices to the people that they buy produce from. And so then those farmers would be calculating what a living wage would be for them, and they would also be figuring out, you know, their costs of production, and then they would show that to the co-op to say, this is what we need for a fair price. And actually it's all sort of like the same kind of process. If the co-op can't or the retailer, buyer, whoever, can't afford to pay that price, they have to do the same thing of like, well, you got to show them your books, you got to explain why you can't afford to pay that yet, and all the other pieces. All right, maybe we should talk about health and safety. So, you know, by law, everybody is entitled to a safe workplace. Employers are required to provide a safe workplace and whatever gear people need in order to be safe in the hazards of the workplace. There's sort of, you know, some additional layers for that in the AJP. The first one is having a full safety plan. Basically a document that sort of outlines, these are the hazards on the farm that we have identified, this is how we're gonna deal with them, and training folks in that plan. Providing personal protective equipment, masks, gloves, you know, whatever it may be. And there are some provisions for non-organic farms, like, you know, certified naturally grown or something, to get Food Justice certified, so we make it really clear that only OMRI listed materials are allowed to be used on the farm. The worker empowerment piece is that if you're a farm that has 10 or more employees, you have to have an ongoing standing safety committee that includes worker leadership, and they have to be empowered to respond to
safety issues as they come up. If you have fewer than 10 employees, you could still do that, or you can just have sort of more informal regular check-ins and meetings and stuff. Thoughts on health and safety?
I'm wondering if this, in the link share, anything, there's guides on ergonomic farm work. Mm-hmm. It's like a big part of the like health part.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so I'll make a little plug for, also in the toolkit, we have everybody should look at the little getting started section because it has basically the greatest hits of our toolkit, all the things that I'm most likely to mention. But we have a template for a full safety plan. And so it kind of, most of it was written by Roxbury Farm in New York, if you guys know them. And it's like a 40-page, very thorough safety plan for a very diversified livestock and produce operation. So you can basically kind of go through and say, all right, well, we don't have cows, so we can cut the cows out, the livestock section out. Or, you know, we only have cows, we don't have the other things. So, but it does include some sample ergonomics stuff. All right, well, maybe we can breeze through real quick. There's like a handful of sort of other topics, other kinds of standards. So one is having a moderate work week. The AJP standards say that you can't require your employees to work more than 48 hours in a week. And any time past that, you could have them work more than that, but it has to be voluntary only. Same way, they have to have the option of at least one day off per week. They could choose to work a seventh day, they could choose to work after 48 hours, but the idea is that it's only, there won't be any penalty if they choose not to. Basic benefits. Farmers are often not required to offer these things, but the AJP standards do stipulate that they have employees have paid sick leave. We have a formula for a sort of minimum of how much people can earn. Folks are required to carry workers' comp, disability, and unemployment insurance. Apprenticeships have to pay at least a minimum wage, and they have to offer substantial learning opportunities to justify paying less than a living wage. And those learning opportunities have to be outlined in a learning contract that's signed by the apprentice and the mentor. And there have to be regular check-ins in the season that are two-way, basically, you know, evaluating the apprentice and the apprentice evaluating the mentor and how the learning process is going. And the last special bucket is nonprofits, because of course nonprofits often have their own struggles because of their governance structure. So basically, staff have to be aware of what's going on at the board level. They have to have opportunities to attend the meetings and to know what's being discussed. And even if it's just as simple as sort of like having a staff sort of memo passed to the board, they have to have some way to participate in that discussion process and make their positions known. There has to be a conflict resolution policy that includes conflicts between staff and board and other board members. Sort of a range of similar things. Okay, so like I said, check out the AJP toolkit. These top two, the model handbook and the safety plan template, are the two most popular items for sure. And they will get you up and running with a lot of what we've talked about. But there's also like dozens and dozens of other things in there which are also handy. It's fully searchable. Also, my job is technical assistance. So if anybody wants to talk more about this, my time is free to you. I can do as much or as little as you like. We have an intake survey that's linked in the handout if you want to do sort of like a full farm assessment, or you can just call and email me with questions. Amy?
I just have a question in regards to the nonprofit. So I know typical nonprofits have, incorporated nonprofits have boards. Our nonprofit is an unincorporated association because we wanted to do something different than, we know there's many, many issues in nonprofit governance. So we don't have a board. We have three mission keepers. So that just, you know, check in about decisions that might, you know, benefit the us as owners personally. So how would that fall under the nonprofit governance? Because we don't have board meetings. We're kind of already a farmer-led, you know, how would that work for that?
No, it's a good question. Well, I'd probably want to know more, but what it sounds like is basically like, you know, as long as those mission keepers are sort of satisfying the basic requirements of involving staff, being included in the conflict resolution process, as long as staff know what's going on and when the meetings are and sort of what's on the table, I think that sounds like it's fine. All the rest of these slides are in the handout. I'm just going to sort of refer you there because Adam has a lot of great stuff to tell us about what's going on in Chicago with the Good Food Purchasing Program.
Cool. Thank you, John.
Yeah.
And if more questions come up regarding his presentation as well, we can loop back to that. I shouldn't take up all of your time. I'm going to talk about good food purchasing. Are folks in here familiar with good food purchasing, the Center for Good Food Purchasing, what that means, what that doesn't mean? Okay. All right. So first I'll start with Chicago Food Policy Action Council. Actually, great photo. This is at Urban Growers Collective, which is an urban farm based in Chicago. We have a representative here. Chicago Food Policy Action Council sort of has its hands in a lot of areas of food access, food equity in the city of Chicago. We do policy work, we do productive landscapes work, land access, supply chain development, and then there's this piece that I'm involved with, which is the centerpiece on the bottom, the Metro Chicago Good Food Purchasing Initiative, and I'll explain the difference between the initiative from the program. We are a very acronym-heavy organization, and there's a lot of convoluted things. We have MSURF. We have a new one called CIFMOB, which is the Chicago Food Mobilization Program, which is a research arm. So we're doing a lot of stuff. Our priorities, as you can see, are environmental justice and food access, and labor rights are a huge portion of that as well. Most of you are farmers and farm workers, but that labor piece includes folks along the supply chain, from farm to plate. So we'll get into it. So, the Center for Good Food Purchasing. What is good food purchasing? It is a policy that takes public institutions and takes a look at their food spend for community meal programs. So community meal program is your public school meals, your hospital meals, carceral meals, nursing homes, park district summer meals. There is so much public money being spent on food that's feeding folks, and it's a way to look at that spend to five different values: a valued workforce, humane treatment of animals, healthy and nutritious, and incorporating community health into those, as well as just local and sustainable. And so what it is, and what we're going to sort of focus on, is AGP, and a lot of the certifications fall under the valued workforce and the environmental sustainability categories. I'm going to try and slow down a little bit since this is very new, and it is very convoluted. So there's these five main values, which are all grounded first on the baseline of equity, accountability, and transparency. So as I'm talking about shifting food spend, the first thing we need to know is what is being spent and where is it being spent and how is it being spent. As we'll work through some of this, and as some of you might know, there's so many different ways that public meal programs are operated. So the city of Chicago has the Chicago Public School Program, and it does not cook meals on site. It is not what's called self-operated. It uses food service management companies, which currently it is split between Aramark, who has roughly 78% of the contract, and then a small woman-owned unionized food service management company that has roughly 20% of the contract, which in theory is great, and we would want to have a contract like that, though the ultimate goal is self-operated. So the reason that's important is New York City, for example, is self-operated, so it's much easier for them to access this information because they are the ones directly purchasing and processing and serving the food, where we're having to go through the complicated nature of a food service management company, either local and private or giant and corporate. Yes. So we will get into the challenges of this process, but just want to reiterate that like the worker livelihood is a really important piece and one of the most important pieces of this framework. Luckily, we're not doing this in a bubble in Chicago. This was first started out in Los Angeles in around 2012. As you can see, Minnesota has a dot, but it is yellow, so it doesn't have a policy on sort of a municipal level. There's no ordinance or resolution tied to it, but the Minneapolis public school system has signed on to be a member and a participant in good food purchasing. There is a really great peer-to-peer networks that are sort of trying to get this information out there, share best practices, how we can incorporate this on a better level. Chicago passed it as a resolution at the end of 2017 after the public school system included it in their wellness policy and after the Park District included it in their wellness policy. Park District serves summer meals and after-school meals. CPS obviously does breakfast, lunch, snack, and supper programs, which all have their own requirements nutritionally and reimbursement rates. And then luckily, we were also able to get Cook County, the county that Chicago sits in, to also sign on as a resolution in May of 2018. So we have like a lot of buy-in from some elected leaders, some of the food service sort of the food directors and the dietitians that are implementing food service at these sites. But technically, the city of Chicago operates other aspects of food service. So there's a lot of concessionary environments. There's the Riverwalk, which has roughly 8 restaurants. There's O'Hare and Midway Airport. We have museums. We have the Parks District-owned Soldier Field, where the Bears play. There's a lot of food spend. So not including those environments, this number is a little outdated. I'd say this is closer to $150 million in the city and Cook County. Cook County mainly just has 3 sites. We have the Cook County Hospital, which is a public hospital. We have the Temporary Juvenile Detention Center, and we have the Cook County Jail. I will say Cook County has been a rock star in this work, and the jail has been the best advocate for this work happening around Chicago. So there's really an emphasis on just engaging all institutions in this work, and you see who sticks, and you see who your champions are. Okay, so how exactly does this work? I'll go into a little detail of like what data collection looks like and how that is analyzed. But after it's analyzed, we get an executive summary and a detailed report that we share with our food service management companies, with the dietitians and the community meal providers to look at the highlights of like, wow, you're buying a local tofu product and you're buying a local organic grain. And then also like you're buying like too much DOD commodity meat. Like, is there something we can do to supplement some of that money in a different way? Once you see that, we also start including contract language changes, which is really important with these food service management companies. So requiring data transparency when we ask for this food spend information. So we need that in our city contracts. In Chicago, we're struggling with that. So sort of considering, is there an executive order that might need to be passed? Because currently in Chicago, it's just a resolution. resolutions don't have any teeth. There's no enforcement mechanism. And actually, the city of New York, Eric Adams, obviously, is really interested in vegan diet, really into compost, hates the rats. They recently signed an executive order, and a part of that is requiring the data transparency. And so we're looking if Chicago could do something similar. I would say that, so since we have such different operations, they are self-op for most of their things, like their school system, which is incredible that they are still on-site scratch cooking at most of their schools. Chicago, unfortunately, had the privatization and the selling off of most of its kitchen infrastructure in the early 90s. Minneapolis, over the past decade, has been spending that time, you might have heard, reincorporating. Yes, so Chicago hasn't even engaged with that. I think they're including new kitchen infrastructure, 1 to 2 schools a year, and sort of piloting. But one thing I will say that's just very interesting is the schools that have the on-site scratch cooking, even when it's the same exact menu that is being done at the central kitchen, so it doesn't matter what school you're at, you're all being served the same food. If it's scratch cooked, they have a higher consumption rate, and they have more students opting into the food just because of the psychology that it is being prepared on site and it's not a heat and serve situation. So, yeah, so this is was a common thing of like removing all that kitchen infrastructure and or just having it sit dilapidated and just go bad and it becomes unusable. So then we have this action plan. We work with food service management companies. We try and ask, you know, who are your distributors? Are there any local distributors that don't need the scale of like Sysco, US Foods that can include products that can be included in your school meals or in your hospital meals, and then every couple years doing another analysis so we can reanalyze the changes and sort of the gaps, which all of this then informs our equitable supply chain development portion of this, because obviously an issue in Illinois is we don't have a lot of diverse fruit and vegetable production, so we need to know on the supply side what is needed or what are the gaps in the value chain, which again, in Illinois, we have a lack of distribution networks and aggregation. So this is like a really important piece. So, yeah.
We're in the state of Wisconsin. You're talking about the state of Chicago, right?
I'm talking about the state of Illinois, but focusing around Chicago metro area, yes. Geographically, they are very close. I would say politically, farming-wise, like things are very different. And that's sort of what I'm alluding to with some of the barriers facing Illinois. But what I'm also saying is there is an opportunity for local growers like Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, Iowa, that is local, to try and enter into these institutional markets if that is what folks are desiring. Obviously, wholesale markets are, if that is, you know, you opt in. Yeah. So highlighting one of the values, so this is a screenshot of the new standards, and so here, this is the valued workforce. The AGP certification is what's considered a level 2, which there's a ranking of 1 is preferred to 3 is like the best option. And so when you're looking at food spend, it'll analyze and it'll say like, oh, you have these fair trade products and you have 18% of them are fair trade. And it's like, okay, well, we needed at least 15%, which maybe I'll use this. So this is the initial assessment. We needed at least 15%. We have 18 at fair trade, but what can we do to then get to this level? And so Food Justice Certified is one of the acknowledged certifications that the Center for Good Food Purchasing utilizes in its analysis. But then on environmental sustainability, AGP is a level 3, which I don't know how they exactly figured that out, that somehow it is stronger environmentally. But regardless, you can see these are a bunch of the logos of the accepted certifications. And the point of this is if we can get institutional markets to shift their preferences of what they're wanting, the distributors will then also be seeking out these things as well, which then means the growers and the food producers will shift towards that. So the thing is like starting at the top and trying to move this gigantic boat at, you know, the slow pace that we're doing it at. Yeah.
So is there the opportunity for growers to get preferred status as vendors in according to those values?
Yes. So I would say that the first thing is working with company, getting preferred status of distributors who use these preferred vendors. That is like the first issue that we're having to navigate. Which there's obviously a growing network of better sort of regional food distributors that are not the Sysco and the U.S. Foods. In Illinois, we have Common Market is really doing wonderful things. Midwest Foods is doing wonderful things. But yes, you will have then a preferred status, and so your product is more easily able to enter into these institutional markets. Obviously, cost is always the initial pushback. And I'll just give one example of a local tofu product in Chicago. It's a company called Phoenix Bean, and they produce a bunch of different tofu products, and none of them are in the plastic in water sort of shell system. Some of them are pre-fried, some of them are used as is, like cook when you get home, but they're...
Soybeans.
Yes, yep. And they do utilize sustainably grown soybeans from Illinois. And this was actually one of the chefs at Open Kitchens, one of the food service management companies that services multiple departments at Chicago. But they were spending so much time, they would buy a pallet of the regular tofu that they would open, drain, press, cook. And they were like, I think there's a product that we open the bag, we heat and serve, which is also more nutritionally dense than the product that is pressed. It then requires less of the product to be included in the meal because it is more nutritionally dense. And currently that is beyond a pilot. There have been multiple pallets that were sold this last fall, and they are sort of ramping up production into the 2024-2025 school year. But it is a woman-owned, local Chicago business that's utilizing sustainably grown Illinois soybeans. And what I'm getting at with the cost is it is a much more expensive product compared to that other tofu, but the amount of labor that is saved because they're not opening, draining, pressing, and frying the tofu. So that's just one example of an entryway into this. And you're using less product too, exactly. The amount, I think there's about 20% loss when you press that kind of tofu, and then it's has less protein content and less calories per serving compared to this Phoenix Bean tofu. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, and just to repeat, an approach to go to distributors at is the fact that less of that product is required to fulfill the nutritional requirements that federal meal programs have, because there's also different requirements between senior meal programs, lunch, supper, snack, and in Chicago, we obviously are also involved in like a new arrivals crisis. And the contracts with that are also very complicated. And so this is another way that we can try and first create transparency. So this is a sample of an executive summary. So you can see here are the five values themselves. and what percentage of that spend hits those value categories. And this printout, so obviously these are fake farms here. But what's really helpful is this information we then share publicly, so folks are able to see what is being purchased. And generally, there's also a huge printout of total food spend, and obviously milk is always the number one food spend for schools. But establishing this also allows growers and food businesses an understanding of like what is being purchased and how much is being purchased. CPS is obviously huge, but a smaller hospital system is an easier entry point. The jail, like I mentioned, is doing an incredible job at the county. And so there are different scales. Also, suburban school districts are another way in. So just wanting folks to know that like there are entry points in through other measures. And I just want to highlight the difference between the Good Food Purchasing Program and the initiative. This requires a lot of work. So asking an institution to do this is one thing, but like shepherding first that data collection, the analysis, working with those folks, and then working on the supply side of like, how do we engage with these institutions to make these shifts? So it requires policy, it requires labor, requires the Chicago Teachers Union to even know that this is a thing so that they can push back on administration on finding ways to like increase reimbursement. So in Michigan, if you are purchasing certain values aligned products, there's an additional, I think it's like 8 cents is added onto each meal, which sounds very small, but is really like drastic and allows for additional products to be included. So this requires like a whole community of folks to do this. It's coordinated. So a lot of times good food purchasing sits in public health departments as sort of the administrators. And so you sort of need somewhere to hold this with turnover in government jobs. Obviously food service directors and dietitians move on. And so I actually sit, I have an interesting role. I sit in the mayor's office working with their policy team, because the city of Chicago does not have any paid food policy or food equity employees. And so I'm what's called detailed. So I work for a nonprofit, work within the city of Chicago. And it actually gives me this really interesting perspective where I'm from a community-based organization and I get to try and really influence local policy. It is an atypical way that this works. I have a colleague of mine who works from the Greater Chicago Food Depository. She also does food equity work alongside me. She runs the Food Equity Council. Her name is Ruby Ferguson. She's a rock star. Chicago, as you know, has food retail issues, a lack of grocery options on the south and west sides of Chicago. This is our community at large, which labor organizing is a really important piece of this as well. And I guess the pitch to you all is the equitable supply chain development is we need growers and we need food businesses that know about good food purchasing, that provide fair labor practices to their employees and are interested in maybe expanding to like an AGP certification or just practicing something that will be viewed as a values aligned vendor and a preferred vendor. And so we have buyer supplier mixers with growers and food businesses, and we'll have Aramark there, we'll have Sodexo there, we'll have local distributors and try and create those connections. Again, want to highlight Common Market and Midwest Foods and the work that they're doing to create easier access points. So you don't have to be to the scale that you're distributing to Sysco. You can be much smaller scale. Another thing we have here, and this might just be more interesting than anything, the transparency piece is huge. So this is a gigantic network of, here's the city of Chicago here. Chicago has departments and sister agencies. So Chicago Public Schools and the Parks District are sister agencies. They have their own procurement departments, their own legal departments. And so you can follow this, and I'll show on this next slide. If you were to click on Cook County Jails, you would see who their food service management company and who their distributors are. This is a public map that we've created. You can see the size of their contract when it's renewed. And this is, again, another way to show how to enter into these procurement markets. And so there's also a dashboard that we're creating that will take the analysis from an assessment that I showed earlier and create it in a more easily legible way for the public to view and then understand. And it's a way to create political will. If a bunch of community organizers that aren't familiar with this learn about what is being served and what could be served, then there's an access point there. And I will say at the end of every analysis is a list of OSHA violations from any of the vendors that those institutions are purchasing from. And there's been three examples of labor that's been able to leverage Good Food Purchasing to push back on products. Amy's Kitchen was one out in the Bay Area. And there's been others where they've leveraged the fact that Good Food Purchasing is a resolution in the city or is an ordinance, and that that institution is using taxpayer dollars to support, you know, Tyson Foods, for example. So I know this is a little shift away from the direct work that John was talking about, but just want you all know that this is a national program. Minneapolis is doing this. This Metro Chicago area is interested in this. Do folks have any questions? There isn't currently an institution or a municipality that's doing this in Iowa, but it's not to say, like, providing a safe workplace that's that provides a livable wage isn't the way forward, and that this is trying to create a national sort of groundswell to sort of shift those access points. Yeah. Yes, yeah, that is, yes, totally. I believe it's 500 miles for meat and then 250 miles from Chicago for considered local. And so there is like some leverage there with how exactly that's calculated. And local isn't, as we all know, local isn't always the most important of those attributes or those values. Sure. So the first statement was about an attempt to do this in Madison and also to create a fair labor standards in Madison. A lot of times, since this is based in procurement, procurement is really complicated at the state level. So one thing, for example, this state of Illinois had a lowest bidder process. So if you went out for bid for your food service management company, it didn't matter what other criteria was shared, whatever things they promised, it was just whoever was cheapest. And that was finally removed back in 2022. So you could create a new weighted score that included anything else in deciding who your food service management company is. But what John's sort of referencing is a lot of times state and city procurement law, New York really struggles with this as well. On there's really no way to enforce labor standards in their procurement contracts, and that you can only give preference to things, you can't require things. So wanting like Wisconsin milk is a requirement you can't do because that's narrowing the procurement scope. within that state. So you'd have to change a state law to allow requirements to be added. So you can give preference to Wisconsin milk, but you couldn't give a required one. So this is, yeah, I call it the unsexy work of institutional procurement because it is so convoluted and it is so different in the same way that cottage law and egg laws are all different between different places and what supersedes who. So, yeah, any... CRB?
I
Okay, like so CRB is what she's talking about as being like almost a consultant that goes and seeks these things out on behalf of like an Aramark. So I don't think we deal with that too much, but we have the typical players of Aramark, Sodexo. Compass is trying to make some changes with their food buy program. We will see how that works out. Yeah, we don't deal with too much of that around Metro Chicago, at least. So a less of a layer, but you're alluding to the fact that the more layers, the harder it is for transparency. But that this is something we all should be wanting and asking for is just transparency to start.
Adam, can you tell the story? I think you were telling me this about ways that was it Common Market or Midwest Foods was sort of helping a BIPOC grower to access more land so that they could expand and then be able to sell more into the system?
Yes. So there was a couple farmers who had a small incubator operation attached to Windy City Harvest, which is the Chicago Botanic Gardens sort of urban ag wing. And Midwest Foods knew that they were struggling to procure, so obviously land access in Chicago is really challenging. Soil remediation is a requirement at every site because of toxic soils. Someone from Midwest Foods, the local food distributor, was able to connect the growers to some folks who knew about some land in southern Cook County to scale, like 10 acres, which is a lot of land for some urban production, so peri-urban, I guess. And now that farm has forward contracts with the University of Chicago. And the University of Chicago uses an iteration of Compass, I believe, is their food service management company. But the fact that, I guess it's a little complicated, it is a private school. We can get into like, what are the best pilots for this work? It is an institution, it is a private higher ed institution, but a university system like University of Illinois at Chicago or thinking about UW-Madison, those are really great entry points. And so I will say in Illinois, our food distributors are doing a lot of work of figuring out how to connect these dots, whether it's creating greater land access or putting them in contact to create the forward contracts for Compass Group. So thank you for reminding me about that story as well. A lot of, so on the procurement angle, on the milk situation too, if you can ever get behind the scenes on how the weighted scores are great, like who decides who gives these contracts, that is also like a black hole that's really hard to enter into. One thing is, for good food purchasing as well, it's engaging like students and organizations that want this. It's engaging with the Chicago Teachers Union, letting those folks know, so then it creates that pressure. Because just going to a food service director, they're overwhelmed, they have a lack of staff. Like, you're asking them to, like, figure out logistics on how can you get local products in, and that's just, like, it's a lot to ask. And so it's really understanding when to be an antagonist and when to be supportive and provide technical assistance and peer learning. And so, yeah, hopefully an opportunity for some of you. Any other questions? Otherwise, I think we're at time.
Yeah, I want to respect folks' time. So I don't know, Emlyn Kaiser, is Emlyn? And Rosanna Lightbody, you guys can figure out between yourselves sort of which book you take.
Wait, did you call my name?
Are you Rosanna Lightbody? Great, nice. Yeah, go for it.
Also, I'm one more thing before everybody goes. The most important thing, we are hosting a Food Justice Summit in Chicago. It's our 19th year. I'm sorry, this is probably what I should have been plugging the whole time.
Just one.
It is 2 days virtual from like 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Feel free to snag that QR code. It is free to attend. You can join us in person on Friday, March 8th at the South Shore Cultural Center. The schedules are all available online. Pop in for an hour on one of the sessions. It'll be on stuff from food waste to poetry as resilience. There's a lot happening, so please join us. Hope to see you there. And please reach out if you need my contact information, or it will be in the slide deck.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much for coming. We can hang out for a little bit. I don't think there's anything coming up next that we need to get out. So if we want to chat, so until maybe 3:15 or so.
Just in your presentation, you kind of skimmed over the safety aspect of it. Uh huh.
Yeah, well, it's everything, you know, sort of from, obviously equipment and vehicles is a major source of hazards. You know, heat, obviously, and like, you know, this past summer, the wildfire smoke and everything. You know, the idea of the safety plan is just that you have sort of something to go off of for when those hazards are gonna happen. Some hazards happen every season, and so you can anticipate them, and then you have a plan for sort of, okay, well, if we have to improvise, this is what we're gonna do.
I'm on the safety committee at work, but we go to the safety meeting, and the safety director is like, well, you know, we got a new color t-shirt for the month, and that's like the end of the safety meeting. It's like, you know, and what's that?
It's like, wait, what?
I know, right? It's like, okay, because they give out a thing called Berry Box. So if they see employees, but day shift has people that can give out Berry Box, and then they have like a rack full of prizes or things that you can buy with your Berry Box. But nobody, there's no way there at night to distribute them, so nobody at night gets any of the Berry Box to buy their merchandise from the safety, you know, rack. But again, it just blows my mind when all we talk about is what the next color of the t-shirt's going to be. And we don't have a lot of personal, like, people injuries, but drivers destroy equipment. I mean, forklifts through freezer doors, drive forklifts through the doors going outside, smash equipment at a rate that you're just like,
Well, hopefully you get a new state legislature, you repeal the right to work, and then you unionize, right?